You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Jamie Williamson grew up thinking his dad was just another Silicon Valley tech nerd. Turns out, his dad was a total badass. Later this hour, a retired rock legend gets an offer he can't refuse. But to start the show, back when Jimmy Carter was president, a little-known Australian director named George Miller made his first super low-budget movie. It starred a little-known Australian actor named Mel Gibson.
Booby-trapped. Touch those tanks and...
But Mad Max was a hit, and Miller's vision became the blueprint for post-apocalyptic life. Now Miller is 70, and he has resurrected the franchise he invented. In Mad Max Fury Road, a warrior played by Charlize Theron is running from a tyrannical warlord.
She thinks she can lose us, Dad!
Like all the Mad Max movies, it is high on epic action and low on dialogue. And it's up for 10 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director. And its director, George Miller, joins me now. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
You grew up and became a doctor, went to medical school along with your twin brother in Australia. So, Dr. Miller, how did you leave that perfectly respectable career to do this?
It was never intentional. I'm always fond of quoting that John Lennon line, life is what happens when you make other plans. And it's definitely true. In my case, I always wanted to be a doctor. I enjoyed being a doctor. But at the same time, I was, when I was at medical school, you were very much more free to explore things. And I was very interested. I did a lot of painting. I did a lot of drawing. And I suddenly became interested in cinema at a time when you couldn't really have a career. There were no movies being made in Australia to speak of, at least by Australians. And then just as I was graduating, I got a chance to make a short film. And I immediately got hooked. And at that time, there were a lot of people making short films in Australia, and there's a whole cohort of people who were just basically driven by enthusiasm. And they included, the likes of Peter Weir and Bruce Beresford and the likes. And suddenly an industry emerged, and I got caught up in that, always with the intention of going back and working as a doctor. I kept working as a doctor while I was making films, basically to earn a living. For about a decade, and then after,
really,
yeah.
So I could have been in Australia, and my doctor was the director of Mad Max.
Yeah.
Wow.
I stayed working as a doctor because you had to have a doctor on set if you're doing stunts.
And I guess with a low budget film, that makes
sense. Yeah, that was the case. And then it got to the stage where I went through with my twin brother, and as time went on, I realized I was forgetting the practice of it, and he's a very good doctor, and I realized I was just falling away from it. So, but by about the mid 80s, I no longer practiced or was registered as a doctor.
So, what made, if there's an answer to this, the young Mad Max auteur, when he got to middle age, create Babe and Happy Feet and another Happy Feet? I mean, we all are people of many parts, but those two things don't seem like natural brothers.
Well, they don't on the surface of it, but a very simple answer to that. I had kids.
You're no longer
going to the movies because it's hard to suddenly spontaneously, let's go and see a movie. So you're watching endless kids' films. And also I really was interested in the technology. The first Babe, it took a while before the digital technology came along and we could actually make the pigs talk.
Move along there, you big buttheads!
And I really remember the moment when Andrew Lesney, who shot the Babe movies, came back from The Lord of the Rings. He was a cinematographer on those movies, and he showed me the first motion capture of Gollum that Peter Jackson and everyone was doing there. And I remember I saw that already having the story of Happy Feet and said, we can make the penguins dance. So I became, you know, it's wonderful to work with these new tools. Now my kids are grown up and I can go back to Mad Max movies.
I figured as much, something like that.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this new Mad Max film, which is essentially a 2-hour car chase. And as I was watching it, it felt so visceral and unusually real compared to a lot of what one sees in movies. And I guess that's because you actually did and shot all this. There wasn't that much digital computer-generated trickery, right?
There was CG involved in enormous number of shots, but it was always supportive of the real-world stuff.
Right.
In other words,
Cleaning up a bit?
Yeah, and particularly harnesses. We had a lot of actors in the stunts and the stunts.
Hanging off vehicles.
And nowadays you can put them on very, very secure harnesses and make sure that they're not going to – nothing untoward's going to happen. And we were able to change landscape. You're able to – the tire tracks, you know, after you've done take one or two or three, you have to erase the previous takes and things like that. We could change skies. We could change landscape and things like that. So there's quite a deal of visual effects, but they were never
That's like makeup. That's post-production opposed to making the image.
But this is a film that didn't defy the laws of physics. There were no flying men or spacecraft. So if you're going to go out into the desert and have two vehicles colliding, why do it artificially, particularly with all the chaos of the dust and so on? It was much better to do it for real when you could. And it turned out over time we were able to do, even if you remember those guys on the poles.
Yes.
I thought initially the physics of that was going to be too dangerous to have, you know, vehicles at speed with guys up there kind of swinging like pendulums up on very high poles. But the stunt crew, rigging crew figured it out how to do it, the effects crew. And
must have been fun for those guys. I mean, because it was so, again, an actual mechanical analog problem.
And exactly. And, it was fun. We even got Tom Hardy up on top of one.
Who's Mad Max.
Yeah, and quite safely, even though he did point out once he got up on top that he was afraid of heights. And so I said, okay, we'll do one or two takes and get you down. And he was able to do that. But it's not a fantasy film in that sense.
Right.
It's real world.
Right.
Yeah.
And how fast were those cars going?
It really depended on the shot and the location. If it was on hard stand road, they could go fairly fast, 120 kilometers an hour.
75 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And was part of the intention and idea that this people will subconsciously know this is real, therefore they will enjoy it more and be more scared, and adrenaline will pump better, and all that.
That was definitely part of it. I think if we had taken something that you can see in real world, at least you can see it on YouTube or on the news, if it was not real, it would look artificial. And I think we read that very quickly. I mean, we certainly read it. We know in human faces, and it's very hard to recreate the human face, and we know about the uncanny valley and so on. I think that same thing applies. Our brain is very efficient at reading things very quickly. So the moment we see something artificial, we acknowledge its artificiality.
It took a long time to make, a dozen years or more, and you had lots of obstacles deciding where to shoot, and will it be Namibia or Australia or somewhere else, and floods and war and lots of things got in your way. Was there ever a moment, a serious moment, where you thought like, nah, this isn't going to happen, and it's not worth it to try to make it happen at this point?
Look, it happens with all films that things get in the way, and sometimes the planets never align. But there's something about this film that you almost couldn't kill with a stick, no matter what got in its way.
Uh-huh.
It somehow kept on being resurrected. I mean, it was greenlit three times by three different studios.
Wow.
And I mean, I thought at a certain point when it was rained out of Australia, unprecedented rains came to the center of Australia, Broken Hill, where we actually shot the second two movies. And suddenly it was a flower garden where there was meant to be a desert.
After years of drought, too.
Yeah, yeah. And so we waited. Warner's said, let's wait 18 months or 12 months, see if it dries up. It didn't. And so he picked everything up and went all the way to the southwest coast of Africa, Namibia, where it never rains, you know, guaranteed desert.
The editor, Margaret Sixel, who usually edits documentaries, except when she works for you,
yeah.
Why do you hire her other than the fact that you're married to her?
Well, it had I not been married to her, I wouldn't know what she was capable of. But she's somebody who's got a very rigorous mind. She's got a very low boredom threshold, so hates repetition.
Uh-huh.
And is very mindful of that very careful orchestration, having a strong causal relationship, one shot to the next. It's not just stringing shots together. And that was very important because there was a great risk that the film could look like every other action movie,
yeah.
Where it's a lot of sound and a lot of, you know, dazzling action.
And leading toward the stunt as a punchline after a punchline. To me, so many chase scenes, that kind of action film is just, you know, there are going to be six big explosion cars turnover, and the rest is just filler getting from one to the next.
Yes. One of the things this film we tried not to do is to have the talky bits followed by the action bits.
Yes.
We were trying to conflate the two. Yeah. And she was very aware that each moment in some way had to inform you of character, relationship of characters, and so on and so on.
And being married to your editor, whom, as you've described, is the editor on any good editor on a film is a close collaborator. So how does that work? Is it good for the marriage, bad for the marriage, better for the editing than if you weren't married to her? I mean, how does that dynamic work?
Well, in this case, I wouldn't normally recommend it, but in this case, it got to the point, you know, where it gets to be gobbledygook to you after a while. You
yes.
see it over and over again.
Yes.
It got to the point where I could completely trust her judgment. Normally, in the editing room, I was the one who'd say, okay, this is what feels right for me, that should it be. But if I lost my way, it's the first time where if ever I lost my way, I would say, okay, you go where you think it should go and see. I don't quite understand what you're getting at, but show me. And she would say it. Do it, and I'd say, oh, okay, I didn't see what you saw, but you're absolutely right. That happened over and over again. And she was not afraid to say it to me. She would say, George, you're wrong. I'm here to avoid you embarrassing yourself, and would be able to reason it out.
You're 70. I am not a young man either. And one thinks of, okay, this is how much time is left. This is what – I don't want to spend my time doing that, but this and this and this, I'd like to get done.
Yes, there's definitely that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stories. Yeah, I've got many more stories than I have yeah. time to tell.
Yes.
But that's what I'm saying. You sort of line them up and you play them in your mind and you say, there's something about that one. If I have just one choice, which is the one I'll
right.
tell? And usually there's one of those that emerges. For better or for worse. That there's no, like, plan.
But I would think, for instance, like, maybe not another Mad Max. I mean, maybe not another Happy Feet.
Yeah, I don't think we'll be making another Happy Feet. I have two other stories for Mad Max, which are in
really?
Script form, and probably not as the next film, but the film after. I would like to do one of them.
And you couldn't. Or could you imagine saying, okay, here's my stories that I've created for other Mad Maxes, but you, guy, you be the director.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah?
There's so many directors out yeah. there that are, you know, people are directing younger and younger. They're getting a real sense of cinema very, very early. And there's some great directors out there.
So you let your child, the Mad Max child, marry one of these people?
Yeah, of course.
Good. George Miller, it's been a great pleasure talking to you today.
Thanks very much, Kurt.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
I talked with George Miller just before the Academy Award nominations were announced, so I asked if he expected to get one. He thought not, but I'll bet you 50 bucks.
All right, we'll do it.
All right.
We'll do it. Australian dollars or American dollars?
I don't know what Australian dollars means.
Make it American dollars and I'll win more.
All right. Of course, Mad Max Fury Road is up for Best Picture, Best Director, and a whole bunch of other Academy Awards, 10. And much to my absolute delight and surprise, right after the nominations were announced, I got an email from George Miller asking how he could get the $50 to me. It's a long way to the top if you wanna rock and roll. By the way, my conversation with George Miller was wonderful and rambling and long, and you can hear it in full as part of our special Director's Cut podcast series. Every week from now until Oscar weekend, we're releasing my conversations with each of the five nominated Best Directors. You can get that as part of the Studio 360 podcast feed on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.